I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Elaine Dewar joins me now. She's just published a new book, The Handover, How Bigwigs and Bureaucrats Transferred Canada's Best Publisher and the Best Part of Our Literary Heritage to a Foreign Multinational. It's an engaging book with investigative journalism from one of Canada's best muckrakers and the author's own memoirs about her experiences with Canadian publishers. The book provides marvelous insight into the state of the Canadian book publishing industry and just how we got to here. The book looks at the venerable McClelland and Stewart, the Canadian publishers, and how its rich legacy transferred from Abby Bennett's ownership in 2000 to an arrangement that saw 75% of its shares go to the University of Toronto and 25% to Random House. Ms. Dewar looks at the laws and regulations then and now and speculates as to how it all happened and how it evolved to recently, where now all of McClelland and Stewart is under the control of Bertelsmann, a German media company. Bennett, who died recently, is interviewed in the book, as are many of the players involved, just as it's interesting to see what those who speak to Elaine have to say and, of course, what they leave out. It's curious to see who don't. Elaine Dewar is an award-winning journalist, author, and television story editor. Visit elainedewar.blogspot.ca for more. This new book is published by Biblioasis. It's a great work of journalism, and Elaine is a fine detective. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Elaine Dewar. Ms. Dewar, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
So as I was telling you before we started and emails that we've exchanged over the last few days, I've just enjoyed this book a great deal, and maybe I enjoyed it because I like the inside baseball stuff, but for people listening to us, would you just set the context in terms of how significant McClelland and Stewart was in the publishing world in this country especially? I mean, that moniker, the Canadian publishers, I mean, they were really it, weren't they?
Well, they were not the only, but they were certainly the most significant Canadian publisher with the longest history of bringing forward Canadian nonfiction and fiction writers and poetry, too. So they were 106 years old, I believe, when they were finally folded into Bertelsmann and disappeared as an entity. But that's a lot of publishing. In fact, this is sort of interesting. At the launch of this book, which was sort of organized in Toronto a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. a publisher named Jack David was doing a sort of interview of, you know, with me of the nature of the story. And he held up a very thick tome, which he'd put together back, I believe, in 1976 or 1980, which was just a bibliography of everything published by McClelland and Stewart.
Wow.
So it's the biggest, most important publisher of Canadian letters and literature there is.
And Jack McClelland, of course, he was the son of the founder.
Correct.
Right, and so in that company goes over 100. It goes back over 100 years.
I think it's 106.
Yeah, but McClelland really in the 60s and 70s really became a larger than life figure, didn't he?
He became he was a wonderful promoter of his projects and his books. He was terrific at getting front page news coverage of, you know, significant works that were coming forward, and he had a wonderful assembly of great talent. I mean, on the nonfiction side, he was the primary publisher of Farley Mowat, Pierre Burton, Peter C. Newman, and on the fiction side, it was everyone from, you know, later on, Atwood, and eventually Alice Munro, Mavis Gallant, Leonard Cohen. The list is just endless, and it really... He and his colleagues created, in large measure, what we now call the Canadian literary canon. Those are the great works that, if you want to understand the evolution of this country, you need to read.
So he tries to sell the company in the early 70s, and so what prevented him from doing that?
No, he didn't try to sell it. He tried to save it in a very crafty fashion. He, in 1967, the centennial year, he published a lot of stuff. He had walked away from publishing for the educational trade, which is a much more stable way to make a living in the book business, to focus and concentrate on Canadian literature, and he blew his brains out. Mm-hmm. So he had a huge bank loan, huge for that day, which was about $1 million from the TD Bank. Interest rates were higher, much higher than they are now, and it was like an anvil around his neck. So as the government of Ontario was entering into an election campaign, which was fraught, he let it be known that either he'd have to sell McClellan and Stewart to foreign interests, or the government had to help him out.
Mm-hmm.
And they helped him out.
And he survives into the, I guess, the mid-80s, is that right?
Yes, and, you know, with various periods of absolute disaster just around the corner, he sold the bulk of all the common shares to Abby Bennett in 1985. I think he retained some preferred shares for a few years and had sort of promised to advise Abby for a couple of years, but they fell out, and off he went.
And so Bennett, who died recently, what line of work was he in?
He was a major developer. His family had started the first development of malls in this country back in the 40s and early 50s. I believe that Principal Investments at one point had all of the major banks leasing offices in their various plazas from one end of the country to the other. They fell on hard times in 61. He sort of scrambled back, paying off what debts he'd signed for personally by the early 70s, and created a new kind of land development business for himself, which by 1985 he was bored to tears with.
Yeah, and so from 85 to 2000, he's the principal owner of McClelland and Stewart.
Yeah, he bought all the shares. He owned 100% of it through his development company, which was called First Plaza.
And so he obviously had no experience in the book business, but in terms of what McClelland and Stewart was publishing in these 15 years or so, I mean, were they still doing good business?
Yes, they were doing terrific business. The business got better because he basically funded it. There was no massive debt because he didn't have to borrow from banks because he was a very, very wealthy guy. He had set up a charitable foundation in 1983 after selling, I believe it was two major plazas to the Murray Frum Group, which may mean nothing to your audience, but Murray Frum was the spouse of Barbara Frum.
And the father of David and
the father of David,
Senator
exactly.
Linda, yeah.
Yep. And I think he founded it with something on the order of 20 or 30 million bucks. That was just, you know, money to give away on an annual basis to charities that he cared about. But First Plazas, his development company, continued on doing business, and it would seem that the debts of McClellan and Stewart had a certain value to First Plazas. It's always nice to have a debt if you're making profit.
And so the appeal of McClellan and Stewart, other than that, I mean, the benefit of owning that for him was what?
Well, two kinds of benefits. I mean, one, he was bored with his own business and he wanted to learn something new. And obviously he knew it was a messy business. He got into it because his daughter-in-law, who had written about baseball, I think she was the first woman to go into the change rooms, of professional baseball. She'd written a book called Foul Balls. Her name was Allison Gordon. She was married to his son, Paul.
Yeah.
And she had a book coming out with M&S in 1984, 1985, and she was coming to Friday night dinners and complaining about the mess in the company. So we sort of got interested. And at that point, McClellan was, of course, in trouble again. And he organized, with the help of the government of Ontario again, a debenture. So people who were sort of public-spirited and wanted to help out the great Canadian nationalist could buy into that debenture, have a tax benefit therefrom, and hopefully help the company turn itself around. And that's how Bennett got involved. He bought into it.
And so by 2000, he's in his 70s now. And
72.
So what's the state of the company at that point?
Well, the state of the company, as far as I could tell from the records I was able to see, was in the year 2000 profitable. He, however, had a very insightful understanding of how the development of the internet, the speed of download, the development of e-books was going to fundamentally change the way the book business worked in the future. In particular, apparently in 1999, he got concerned about Amazon, that Amazon would pay no attention to national boundaries, which is how books are traditionally sold. And he tested his theory by ordering an Alice Munro book, which had been published both in Canada and by another company in the U.S., ordered it from Amazon U.S., and had it delivered to a Canadian address. And when the book arrived, he realized that the foreign rights business was going to die because it would be very, very difficult in future to police those boundaries. So he, at I think it was one of the group book launches in the fall of 1999, he basically said, we're in trouble, this business is going to hell, Amazon is going to destroy us. And, you know, 6 months later, he'd arranged his exit.
And
sort of exit.
Yeah, and it's an exit that involves a number of parties, and it's a complicated thing. But I guess the basic arrangement is that 75% of the shares of McLeland and Stewart go to the University of Toronto. He sells the rest, the 25%, to Random House, which at that point was it an American company still?
It was owned by then by Bertelsmann.
I see. So it's a German company.
It's a German-owned company which has a relationship to its former American subsidiary. But by then, Bertelsmann owned all of Random House worldwide.
Yeah, and so 75 and 25.
So 75% to U of T was a gift.
Yeah.
Meaning it attracted a charitable tax. And the 25% sale to Random House was a straight sale for which he was paid a significant amount of money.
And so in 2000, he could not sell it to Bertelsmann outright, could he?
He could not without the permission of the Minister of Canadian Heritage, who was extremely unlikely to give that permission.
Yeah.
There were rules in place from Jack McClellan's day, going back to 1974, first under what was called the FIRA, the Foreign Investment Review Act, that any Canadian company in any area, I mean, never mind books and publishing, all of that was sort of under the aegis of the FIRA, could not be sold to a foreign entity without the permission then of the Minister of Industry. After Mulroney came to power, the act was changed to be called the Investment Canada Act. Publishers, distributors, booksellers, and a number of other industries still fell under that act and were prohibited from being sold to foreigners without the express permission of the minister, who would extract a net benefit for Canada. And if no net benefit could be extracted, the sale could be forbidden. So he managed to get his deal done in a very interesting way. When I first read about it, I couldn't understand why he bothered to go to Ottawa at all, because 25% sale to Random House would not have been significant enough to give rise to the minister having to review it. And yet, at the press conference to announce the gift and sale, when someone asked a question about that, Doug Gibson said, it's all been approved in advance by Ottawa, no problem. So you sort of had to think about that. Well, why? Why did he have to go to Ottawa to get approval? And therein lay a story.
Yeah, and so you do the spade work in terms of finding out the reasons for seeking Ottawa's approval at that time. But just a question on the University of Toronto. Did they see it in 2000 as a benefit to them to get these shares?
Well, they certainly said they did.
Yeah.
They told the business board, which is part of the governing council, which actually received the gift for the U of T, their evaluation was that, you know, this new arrangement, especially with Random House having a management contract, would create benefits in the way of profits. And from those profits, the U of T would get to endow various cultural funds, one of which I think was to be called the Bennett Endowment, to produce all kinds of net benefits to the University of Toronto. So the theory, as you know, laid out in summary form, was that there would be economies of scale, that the very able managers of Random House would help M&S become a much more profitable company, and the profits would by and large flow to U of T. Of course, if you looked at the underlying agreement or set of agreements that made this gift and sale possible, it was obvious on its face that Random House could prevent any profits from ever flowing to U of T, and indeed no profits ever did flow to U of T.
So in the 17 years since this deal, which is...
In the 15 years that U of T owned it.
Yeah, so...
Not one penny. However, Mr. Bennett's company, First Plaza's, got a $15.9 million tax credit for making that donation.
Which would be 75% of
the total value of the company.
Yeah. So you talk to a lot of people in the book, and then there's a lot of people that don't want to talk to you. As well.
A lot of people didn't want to talk to me.
Yeah. Were you surprised by, because a lot of people that you did get to talk to, like Abby Bennett and Doug Gibson and others on the board at the time, Trina McQueen, I think, is one, and Arlene Ray. Were you surprised at some of the things that they told you?
Well, sure. It depends on which we're talking about first.
Yeah.
I think, you know, what was surprising to me was that most of those who are somewhat lower down in the book business or still involved, either agents or other publishers who are still active, absolutely would not speak to me or go on the record if they did speak to me. No one at the University of Toronto who had anything to do with the deal during the period in which the gift was made or during the period in which the U of T held those shares would talk to me at all. Not one. Even people who were peripheral wouldn't talk to me. So I was shocked when Abby Bennett said, yeah, come on over.
Yeah.
And it soon became apparent that he had something to get off his chest.
Yeah, some of the people that talked to you, though, it seemed like they had something to get off their chest. I mean, request documents from the university later on, and you get stuff that weren't probably for public eyes.
Oh, definitely were not for public
yeah.
eyes.
And so it's
I got under the Freedom of Information Protection of Privacy Act a number of documents, all of the contracts which were written in order to affect the gift of shares and the sale of shares and the management agreement with Random House. And the lawyer's letter that was written to the Minister of Canadian Heritage in 2000 in order to get approval for the deal. And what was so interesting about all of these documents is that they were styled privileged and confidential, as they had solicitor-client privilege,
mm-hmm.
or privileged and protected under the Investment Canada Act, meaning the Investment Canada Act has provisions which make it illegal for the government to produce any of the underlying documents for a ministerial decision. So what I was given was shockingly good
yeah.
and very, very surprising in every way.
So how do you go about publishing some of that stuff?
I mean, you just publish it.
Sorry?
You just publish it.
Yeah, but I mean, does it have to get lawyered by Biblioasis and stuff like that?
Lawyering happens when you have a concern about defamation. But in this case, really, the lawyering was fairly simple. I had no legal obligation not to publish those documents.
Does someone get in trouble for say, providing those documents to...
No, because it went through the Freedom of Information Protection of Privacy Act people in charge at the University of Toronto. So someone at University of Toronto decided, and it would have had to be someone very high up in the administration, that they wanted these documents to be looked at by a reasonable and responsible journalist, that being me.
Yeah. So
they let them go.
So
now the question is, mm-hmm. did they also get permission to release those documents from the other parties? Normally under the FIPA, you would have to get the agreement of the other parties to release those documents. I do not know if the University of Toronto phoned up Random House and said, can we show these contracts? I do know that there was a confidentiality agreement with the contracts which would have made such a call obligatory.
Mm. Now, in terms of what you saw, did you see anything that was perhaps illegal or incorrect in terms of this deal that was cultivated in 2000?
No, this deal was made legal by ministerial opinion. In effect, Random House, when Mr. Bennett approached them with his plan, said, yeah, we'll do this deal with you, provided you can get a ministerial letter which says that the new arrangement will still be considered to be a Canadian entity under the law. In other words, showing all of the contracts which gave Random House de facto control of the new entity right from the get-go, the minister nevertheless signed off and said, yep, company's still Canadian. Hmm. Meaning all of the grants and all of the tax credits that they applied for over the course of the next 15 years were legal.
Now, is there a suggestion that some of the grants that M&S got in this period were perhaps incorrectly received, I should say?
Well, the Investment Canada Act and the Tax Act sort of differ on what means de facto control, but the Investment Canada Act is pretty darn clear. The point is that if you have over 25% ownership and have the ability to control the expenditure of money, control of bank accounts, control of loans, and the ability to create a bankruptcy, then you have control of the company. A lot of the grants that are supplied by the Government of Canada or the Government of Ontario require the recipient to be 75% owned and controlled by Canadians, right?
Yeah.
So de facto control in the hands of a foreign-owned entity, one would think that it would be improper or improbable that such an entity would be able to get those grants and tax credits. But M&S applied for them and received them for the 15 years in which U of T had 75% of the shares.
So in the 15 years that U of T had these shares, where would M&S, say, employees, people who have contracts with the publisher?
I said 15 years. They owned it between 2000 and 2011.
So 11 years, a decade or so. Who would write the checks?
Well, that's an interesting question. One of the first informants I spoke to who insisted on anonymity said that Random House wrote the checks. When I asked Doug Gibson, who was the president and the publisher of M&S for the first 4 years of this arrangement, who had written the checks, he said he didn't know.
Hmm.
The agreements clearly show that Random House wrote the checks, because Random House had complete control of the bank account.
Right. So thus far, it's a fascinating story. It's an important book if you're a Canadian. Someone asks you in the course of writing the book, why should we care, and essentially, why should you care? And, you know, I'm sitting here in Vancouver, a British Columbian, and I'm thinking of the book that I've just read. It's rather Toronto-centric. I mean, there are people who go to the same schools, the same universities, the same clubs. They have the same honorifics. They're all members of the Order of Canada.
They're all members of the Order of Canada.
Yeah. So, I mean... But I find it fascinating nonetheless. But I mean, why should people listen to us care?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I can tell you why writers should care. Writers like me care because we have, over the course of the last 20 or 30 years, as a country, invested hundreds of millions of dollars in producing Canadian literature through Canadian companies. Canadian literature written by Canadians, about Canadians, for Canadians. There is no incentive for foreign-owned companies to come here and produce works by Canadians if their major market is elsewhere. The whole reason for a nationalist publishing policy, which sort of was created on the fly from 1971 forward, was to remedy what was a terrible situation in this country. Back in 1951, the Massey Levesque Commission on Arts and Letters discovered that in 1948, only 14 novels and 35 dramas were published by Canadian-owned entities in this country, period. That was a huge decline from the way things were in the 1930s when some Canadian-owned companies, Ryerson Press, Gage, were doing as many as 80 books a year.
Mm-hmm.
So fast forward to the 70s, and what you had was a marketplace entirely dominated by foreign-domiciled publishing houses who really had no interest in Canadian readers other than as buyers of works originated elsewhere. You can't have a country, or at least this is the argument that nationalists make, if you don't have any means to tell your stories and reflect yourself to each other. So the whole purpose of the nationalist policies on culture were to remedy what had become an overwhelmingly foreign-dominated marketplace for ideas. So fast forward to 2000 to 2011. Bertelsmann has by then become the dominant publishing company in English in the world. Its domicile is in Germany. It has publishing entities in the UK, publishing entities in the United States, and all over the rest of the world. And, of course, it owns what became Penguin Random House of Canada. Random House was always, from the 80s onwards, the largest foreign-owned entity operating in this country. And by the time of the sale, or the, I guess you could call it the transfer by U of T of its shares of M&S into Random House's hands in 2011, it was by far the largest publishing entity in the country. It now has 32% of the market. In the Competition Bureau's terms, 32% or 33% of a market share is the point at which the Competition Bureau assumes there is abusive behavior and starts to investigate. Well, when we're talking about the world of ideas, the idea that maybe only two people are making publishing decisions for one-third of the English-Canadian publishing market, I don't know about you, but that scares me.
Now, has the Competition Bureau or any other governmental agency, have they looked into this at all?
We don't know, because they keep it a secret.
There's a lot of lessons in this book, and I'll get into what I think are the lessons in a sec. But one of them, I guess, is what Canadians ought to do at this point. And other than buy your book and get outraged, what do you suggest we do?
Well, the Minister of Canadian Heritage has been holding what she calls consultations with the public about the creation of a new cultural policy for the digital age. I recount in the book one of those consultations which I attended in Toronto, which was just a bloody farce.
Yeah, it's actually quite, it's amusing to read, I should say.
It's funny, but it's terrifying.
It is,
because
yeah.
you realize that the policy has obviously been decided in Ottawa before the consultation has taken place. The consultation is sort of directed by who is invited to be consulted, and everybody else is kept at arm's length, especially journalists like me. So, you know, there's a new cultural policy coming. It will be announced in September. It is probably going to tear down the normal rules with regard to Canadian content for television and radio. We've already seen a collapse of the newspaper business in this country and of local news in this country. When asked if there was any chance at all that the federal government would actually support journalism by creating a fund that newspapers could use to fund it as they're shrinking and their audience is shrinking, the Prime Minister shot that idea down in about 30 seconds. And the Minister, Madame Joly, has basically said she has no interest in helping newspapers either. So we're in a terrible spot here, and it seems to me that if Canadians actually want to have a country in which they have some idea of what's going on, meaning they need investigative journalism going on in major papers across the country, they need local news that's actually reliable mm-hmm. and not fact-free, we all have to stand up and say, you know what? let's have a real conversation about this, about how we're going to do this and what we're going to do.
Well, one review of the book online that I read said that in the course of the book, you focus on this 32% share of the market, but sort of, I don't know if you gloss over, but it's sort of the work of the small presses throughout the country.
Yeah, I'm told that, you know, small presses will fill the bill and everything's going to be fine. Let me tell you how that works. If you are publishing with a large multinational, the advance that you're probably going to get for your nonfiction book in particular is going to be 5 or 6 times the advance that any small press is able to pay you. So, for example, this book, which was done very fast and with no travel, 2 years from start to finish, I got a teeny advance from my publisher because that's all they could afford.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, my publisher would not have an insurance policy, would not have a fund to hire a lawyer, in other words, would be unable to carry forward the kind of investigative nonfiction that this country has done really well. So it's not possible to substitute forever for the large advances that have been paid and are payable by large corporations. Little presses who, you know, if they're lucky, can put up a $6,000 advance, part of which will be formed by a grant. I mean, you can't do the work.
Yeah.
It's impossible. So it's much worse on the nonfiction side than the fiction side. But even on the fiction side, every little press will tell you that they groom starting novelists who are then, if they succeed, immediately plucked by a large foreign-owned company because that foreign-owned company can afford to pay a great deal more of an advance. And if that person succeeds and has a wonderful, you know, set of reviews on the next book and it sells a zillion, all well and good. If it doesn't succeed, they're dropped like a hot potato. They're gone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one shot. You get one shot. That's it.
What, in terms of the process of writing this book, I guess there are lessons to be derived for the kind of work that you've done in this book, and you know, there's a lot of shouting, there's a lot of you know, emails back and forth and checks that you have to write.
The,
you know,
shouting at the end where I'm getting tired of being told I can't have that list.
Right.
That part?
Yeah. So I mean, for people listening to us who want to get into to sort of this line of investigative nonfiction, I mean, what's the lesson here for them?
Well, the lesson is we've got a federal government which had promised when it was running for election to change the rules of the Access to Information Act. We should have a right as Canadians, as a matter of course, to most of the documents produced by governments about what they're doing, about the policy-making process, about how they interpret events. I mean, all of that stuff should be, as a matter of course, open for Canadians to see. It came as a shock to me, well, a surprise, that there are 1.6 million documents currently residing in the Privy Council office which relate to the Cold War. I mean, these documents are well past 30 years old, and they can't be released scholars or anybody else who needs to know what the heck happened here during the Cold War. We have an obsession with secrecy, and it will kill us as a democracy. It will kill us.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason you find it funny at the end of the book that I can't get the list of 5 MPs who attended a public function, 5 MPs?
Yeah.
Because according to the access people at the Department of Canadian Heritage, they don't make lists. You know, that's where we're at. We can't get even the most basic and simple information out of our own government.
There's a great lesson in here for listening as well. I mean, you mentioned a conversation that Alison Gordon had with her father-in-law.
Yeah.
And the significance of what he said while she came to dinner on a Friday night. And you picked up on that and just how important, and then that led into a field of inquiry beyond, you know, his interest in getting the company, right?
I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Well, you, just in terms of listening, I mean, you're talking to Doug Gibson as well, and he's telling you where Abby Bennett's living now.
And I find out it's the same place as my mother's living, which
yeah.
I actually knew. Yeah. I mean, the thing about Toronto and people who work in a glamour business, you know, publishing is supposed to be a glamour business. Maybe at the top it is. Down where I work, it is not. But they all know each other. They've known each other forever. So, for example, the same guy who was the president of University of Toronto receiving the gift from Abby Bennett in 2000 is Robert Pritchard. Robert Pritchard then ends up, a few years later, being the president and CEO of Torstar, which owns the Toronto Star. The Toronto Star owned Harlequin Books. Mm. And was having a really bad patch. So, you know, up to Ottawa goes Mr. Pritchard, having participated in Abby Bennett's run around the Investment Canada Act, and organizes another ministerial letter of opinion which permits the Toronto Star to sell Harlequin, which is making a lot of money, a Canadian publisher, to HarperCollins, a foreign publisher, for $455 million. The same guy, Robert Pritchard, gets put on the board of Penguin Canada, and talks to the minister and makes sure that when Penguin and Penguin Random House merge, that Penguin Canada is also permitted to merge with Random House Canada, which needs a ministerial approval. So one guy, three major deals, and by the way, he's a childhood friend of the guy who is, you know, had been the publisher of the Toronto Star for years, John Hondrick. And a good friend of Abby Bennett. I mean, they're all friends.
Yeah. So you can understand, sitting here in British Columbia, listening to all this, we're a little hesitant to say buy into whatever Canadian nationalism is.
Except that there are Canadian publishers in British Columbia who fell upon hard times, I mean, Douglas and McIntyre.
Right.
Who could have been helped by bureaucrats if they had so chosen, who might have done better selling to a foreigner. They'd still be around, as
yeah.
opposed to simply their name being around. You know, there are, it's a fact of history that about 80% of English-Canadian publishing happens in Ontario. It's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
Ontario has a larger population and obviously was able to start publishing before British Columbia entered into Confederation. So it's like, how to put this? It is not Toronto-centric in intent. It's an accident of history.
Right. Another thought that I had after reading your book is because you talk about a number of figures in the book. Near the end of the book, you attended Ellen Seligman's funeral, the legendary
yeah.
editor. Was the idea that there are a lot of Americans who come here and explain this country to us, like John Bentley Mays, Jared Bland, I think, is American, isn't he?
I think he was born in the U.S. I don't know if he's still an American citizen, but definitely comes from the U.S.
Yeah, so he's the, I guess, the current head of...
He's the current publisher of M&S, replacing
yeah.
a Canadian publisher of M&S named Doug Pepper.
Yeah, so, I mean, do you have any thoughts as to why Americans come here and feel that they... Well, I don't know if they feel they need to explain this country to us, but they end up doing so.
I think it's because we are neighbors, we're related to each other, we share a huge amount of cultural and other kinds of economic information. I mean, we're each other's largest trading partner, and it's been that way for a very long time. So Ellen Seligman ends up here and ends up at M&S and is happy as a clam because of, I believe she called it her independence, and she was, to a large extent, independent. She made the judgments that she wanted to make. She advanced the people she thought had talent, and people backed her. Another guy, American, who came here and did very well was David Kent, who ran Random House the year I did my first book with them, then went on to run HarperCollins Canada. And again, you know, these guys considered themselves Canadian. And in many ways, they were. You can't make rules that say just because someone was born in New York means that they can't come to Canada and do great work. They did great work.
What have you heard from readers of the book, especially those in Toronto, those in the publishing business?
Well, there was a very interesting launch
in
which people came up to me and related me, and in some cases they were the same people who'd refused to talk to me even off the record. That was kind of interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, for you, I mean, the experience of writing this, you probably won't get published by Random House now after this.
No, but... I should think that's over. Yes.
So I mean, what is that? What has that told you about, say, publishing in this country? I mean, you're still writing.
Well, exactly what I'm trying to say here is that really matters is that the federal government, by means of the decisions it's made over the past 20 years, really, has created a marketplace that is completely fearful because there is only one major bookselling chain. The government permitted that to happen. And there is one dominant foreign-owned book publisher. The government permitted that to happen, too. So it's a marketplace controlled by very few people. And if you get on the wrong side of those people, obviously your career is going to suffer. Everybody knows that. Everybody's afraid of that. And they act accordingly. And that is dreadful.
But you're hopeful that the people pick up this book, right?
I am.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a book
they can read it in secret.
Yeah. it's a book that people need to read, and it's such a good book. I bought a copy, as you know, before your publisher sent me a copy.
I thank you for saying that. It's very kind.
I've done my part, I guess, right?
Yes.
Elaine,
my publisher didn't send it to you? You mean you bought it?
Well, no, I bought it. I ordered it before they sent me a copy. So
It
sort of crossed in the mail there. But congratulations and continued good luck with this book. I do hope a lot of people pick this up.
I thank you very much, and I hope so too.
The book is called The Handover, How Bigwigs and Bureaucrats Transferred Canada's Best Publisher and the Best Part of Our Literary Heritage to a Foreign Multinational. It's published by Biblioasis. Its author, Elaine Duer, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.